This is Heidi, and I will be reading from the June-July issue of Guideposts today. The first article is under Someone Cares, Pass It On. Featured creatures. I love to crochet, and I'm always looking for ways to use my hobby to make others smile. I found a creative opportunity when I came across an article about a first grade teacher in Melbourne, Australia, who asked each of her students to draw a creature from their imagination. Then she proceeded to crochet and sew an adorable plush replica of each child's drawing. She crafted all kinds of creatures, including dinosaurs, insects, and Nessie the Loch Ness Monster. Her students loved their new toys, and they became prized possessions. The article noted that this teacher, who wants to remain anonymous, has made a one-of-a-kind stuffed toy for each of her students for several years now. She even delivered them to the students' homes when schools were closed during the pandemic. I don't have any grandkids yet, but I do have nieces and nephews who'd love a homemade toy made from one of their drawings. I also know a few teachers who might enjoy gifting their students such a special item, and it would really make me happy to help with a fun project that celebrates how unique and imaginative kids are. By Beth Gormung of Noblesville, Indiana. The next story is a passing but lasting compliment. I was walking through the mall one day when a woman passing by said, "I like your shoes." I glanced down at my well-worn tennis shoes and wondered what was special enough about them to warrant a compliment. My shoes seemed pretty ordinary to me. Still, her kind words stuck with me for the rest of the day. That experience has inspired me to look for ways to give a small but sincere compliments to strangers. A man in the grocery store was wearing an unusual shirt, so I called out to him, "That's a handsome shirt you're wearing." As I pushed my cart past him, a delighted expression dawned on his face, which I found very rewarding. I might compliment the color of a lady's nail polish or someone's lovely smile or stop to tell a parent what nice manners her child has. There's a saying that as we get older, we get bolder. I'm 89 years young, and I am not shy when it comes to sharing kind words with strangers. I've learned from experience that a sincere and unexpected compliment can stay with us for hours or days, maybe even forever. That's by Helen Spapala of Chadsford, Pennsylvania. Under Mysterious Ways, More Than a Coincidence. My dad had a funny habit of barking at our elderly Shih Tzu, Daisy, whenever he came into our home. "Woof, woof," he'd say, and Daisy would wag her tail and bark back. "Good dog," he'd praise her. It always made me smile. Dad had dementia and lived in a senior community not too far from us. I hadn't been able to visit him for months because of COVID restrictions, so we would have regular FaceTime calls. Each day, when I talked with my father, we had the same ritual. He'd bark at Daisy, he'd shout, "Hi, buddy," at my husband, Steve. Then he'd tell me what he'd eaten for lunch and dinner and who had called him. I didn't know if Dad was making everything up or if he actually remembered the events of his day. He'd ask what I'd been up to, and I would give him a full report, though I was never confident how much Dad really retained. I could only pray that those calls meant as much to him as they did to me. As the months rolled on, Dad's memory worsened, as we knew it would. He would tell me that no one had called, even though I knew my brother had just spoken with him. About the same time, Daisy, who was nearly 16 years old and diabetic, began to decline significantly. She wouldn't eat regularly and bumped into walls. That November, Dad's health took a turn. He bounced back and forth from a nursing home to the hospital. The day before he passed away in December, I was allowed to see him to say goodbye. As I grieved, I prayed we wouldn't lose Daisy too. Steve and I discussed whether we needed to have her put to sleep. Daisy's vet said she wasn't in pain and to give her extra love. That's exactly what we did. Then, one February afternoon, Daisy collapsed. Steve and I took shifts, holding her wrapped in a blanket. In silence, I rocked her. God, I don't know if I can stand more heartache. The next morning, while I was doing dishes, I felt an urge to ask my father, Dad, help Daisy cross over. I distinctly heard my father's voice bark out, Woof! A few moments later, Steve came into the kitchen and told me that Daisy had passed. Thank you, Dad, I whispered. Through my tears, I smiled. That was Tess Clarkson of Missouri. When we help other people, we establish an experience or a connection with them, but we also remind ourselves of the value that we bring to the world. Dr. Murthy, he's a U.S. Surgeon General, on how to combat the public health epidemic of loneliness in this country. And another quote by Michael Todd, lead pastor of Transformation Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He says, God can't bless you who pretend to be. He can only bless who you really are. Under faith and living, in the everyday, cooking, cleaning, breaking up kids' fights, if only I had a few minutes for myself, by Miriam Green of Beersheba, Israel. Dishes already filled the sink, and my three children hadn't even finished their breakfast. Hurry up or you'll be late, I said. Rafi, finish your juice. Leora, did you put your bicycle away? Rafi, that's my juice, my youngest Hillel shouted at his brother. Is not, Rafi yelled back. That's enough, I snapped. Finish your breakfast and go brush your teeth. Over the noise of the faucet, I could hear the boys still squabbling as they left the kitchen. Rinsing a dish, I reminded myself of the Amida, the prayer at the core of the daily services, prayer services. Alohi, my God, guard my tongue from evil and my lips from speaking deceitfully. Open my heart to your Torah so that my soul will pursue your commandments. That's not easy in this house, I thought. I was constantly yelling at the kids to behave, feeling angry, and put upon. God got my focus at the synagogue, and during the prayers I recited daily, but it was hard to feel his presence all the other hours of the day when I was busy being the linchpin of our family's daily existence. With the kids off to school and my husband at work, I left the breakfast dishes soaking and turned to the laundry, picked up scattered toys, wrapped up a half-eaten sandwich someone had left by the couch, vacuumed the rug. Every task felt like another burden. What about me, God? I put away the vacuum and stood for a moment in the living room. If only I had an escape from all this drudgery. I envisioned myself as a balloon, filling with air and floating toward the ceiling, away from the demands of everyday life. Me, 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 I chanted as I glided upward, imagining what I'd do with my newly found time, work on my writing, or simply sit with my thoughts. Finally, I was drifting alone in a place where small, needy hands could not reach me. I tapped the ceiling with my hands that were so used to being busy From this vantage point, I could see how my home life would unfold without my active presence. What I saw surprised me. Leora's bicycle found its way to the shed. Someone other than me put away the half-eaten sandwich. The boys eventually stopped fighting on their own. I let my balloon self-deflate. Maybe I wasn't the center of the universe after all. Maybe I didn't have to be. Instead, I could be a conduit for God's love. Why wait until I was at the synagogue to pray when I could find God everywhere, even in dirty dishes? Those monotonous tasks were precious opportunities to express my love for my family, as God contracted his infinite self to create the universe. I needed to contract myself to give freely to others. I went back to the kitchen sink where the breakfast dishes awaited. I remembered the Midrash and interpretation of Bible text that says Moses, or Mosh in Hebrew, got his name from because Pharaoh's daughter miraculously stretched out her arms to retrieve him from the Nile, and the Mosh drew him in. Keeping that image in mind, I stretched my arms toward the dishes before me. Even the high priests in the temple have to do a lot of drudge work to prepare for daily services, I reminded myself. If they can find God in those tasks, so can I. My husband worked late and came home that night to find me in the kitchen, surrounded by more dirty dishes, this time from dinner. He kissed me gently on the back of my neck. "Need any help?" he asked. I stepped aside and let him take over. My son, Halil, appeared at my side. "Can I have a hug?" I happily stretched out my arms. Our returning troops, Harold and me. They're nearly all gone now, the generation we call the greatest, quote unquote. This woman's mission was to honor one of them. By Patty Jo Caterson of Montrose, Pennsylvania. I scan the line of older gentlemen boarding the charter bus, looking for the veteran I'd be accompanying on a two-day tour of the war memorials in Washington, D.C. That Saturday morning in September 2019 was my first time volunteering for Honor Flight, and I wanted everything to go smoothly. Planning is something I'm big on. I checked name tags. None said Harold Gary. Harold was 98, a World War II veteran, one of the last of the greatest generation. I admire the men and women who serve our country. My late parents were Air Force veterans. I thought of following in their footsteps, but my dad wouldn't hear of it. I went into accounting, then IT, eventually working for Lockheed Martin, a defense contractor. Maybe the seed had been planted in my teens when I watched my proud father step off the plane from Vietnam in civilian clothes so protesters wouldn't spit on him. But I'd long felt a pull to do something more for veterans. I'd ask my gods for God's guidance about it as I got closer to retirement age. Several weeks earlier, my company had held a fundraiser for Honor Flight. "Is there a way to volunteer?" I asked. So here I was, hoping to give back in some small way. At last, I spotted Harold. He'd been standing to the side, letting everyone else board the bus ahead of him. I introduced myself. "Were you waiting for me?" "No, no," Harold said. "These other veterans deserve the best seats." How could a World War II veteran feel unworthy of respect? Right then and there, I made it my mission to show Harold that he too was a hero. On the ride to D.C., I asked about his service. Bit by bit, his story came out. I grew up on a dairy farm during the Depression, he said. Seven of us kids, but I was the closest to my brother, Dana. We called him Dan. He was 2 years younger. We were inseparable. Harold attended college for a year, but by 1942, the U.S. was in the thick of the war. At 21, he joined the Navy, finishing at the top of his class at Air Gunner School. He served as a flight engineer slash gunner and aviation mechanic aboard a patrol bomber that guarded U.S. warships sailing to Europe. His crew was based in the United States. I didn't do much, he said, not like Dan. I'm here for him. Your service matters too, I wanted to tell him. Dan joined the Army Air Force and went to England with the 390th Bomb Group, Harold said. A captain, Dan led a squadron on bombing raids over Europe. On November 30th, 1944, his 25th raid, Mission 222, his crew bombed a synthetic oil plant in Germany. Flying home, he was hit by an anti-aircraft fire. His plane burst into flames, rolled, and hit another, Harold told me. Both crashed and exploded. Harold paused. His grief was palpable. This is why he felt he hadn't done enough. Dan's buried in Belgium, he said. I've never had the opportunity to go over there. I don't guess I'll ever get the chance. I figured this bus trip was a way of honoring my brother. I'm so sorry, I said. That's not something you ever get over, I know. But without men like you, Dan might not have made it to Europe. You're a hero, too. He shrugged and shook his head. In D.C., he went to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the Korean War Veterans Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial, and the U.S. Marine Corps War Memorial. At Arlington National Cemetery, we watched the changing of the guard. Harold stood for the entire hour. The next day, we visited the World War II Memorial. Harold's vision was limited, so I read him quotes on the marble walls. He talked about Pearl Harbor and D-Day, the servicemen who had fought and died together. Not a day passes that I don't think about Dan, he said. I wish people knew more about what he did. On the bus back to Pennsylvania, I told Harold more about myself. Like him, I was one of seven kids. As a military brat, I'd lived all over the world. I felt like I'm from everywhere and nowhere, I said. Harold chuckled. My husband Chris was from Montrose, Pennsylvania, and we'd settled there, raised our family. Harold, too, lived in Montrose. It's a small town, population 1363. It was surprising we'd never met before. Was there a reason God had brought us together now? It was hard to tell what I accomplished in these past 2 days with Harold. He still didn't see himself as anyone special. We said our goodbyes. I couldn't get Harold out of my mind, so I called him the next day. How are you doing after all that walking? I said. I'm definitely feeling it. I'm a little tired, he said. Nothing a couple of extra naps can't cure. I wish I had your energy, I said. A few days later, I called again. I kept calling every week just to chat, drawn to him in a way I couldn't quite explain. I invited Harold over one Saturday to meet Chris. Turns out they had been eating breakfast every Friday at the same diner for years and already knew each other by sight. In March 2020, the country went into pandemic lockdown. Harold and I spoke every day. He was coping better than I was. He worked on a weekly missive he emailed to close friends and family. At the end of May, he turned 99. I organized a parade in which people drove by his apartment building to wish him happy birthday. For his 100th, Harold wanted to hold a walk-a-thon to benefit Honor Flight. I helped him put it together with assistance from Honor Flight. Like I said, I'm big on planning. He made the local news and raised more than $6,000. The more I got to know Harold, the more I admired him. He worked until he was almost 90, farming, driving trucks. He raised 6 children. He still walked 2 miles a day. With his 101st birthday approaching, I knew what I needed to do. Got plans for your birthday? I asked. You going to tell me? He replied mischievously. You'll need a passport, I said. Chris and I want to take you to Belgium to visit Dan's grave. He was quiet for a moment. I'd like that, he said. He flew to England in June 2022. I'd learned there was a small museum at Parham Airfield in Framlingham where Dan had been stationed. I didn't expect much. Originally, the museum wasn't even going to be open the day we could be there. I told the chairman I was bringing Dana Gary's brother. Captain Gary, he replied, we'll open for you. My staff will be at your disposal. They led us to a board with the names of 742 fallen airmen. At the sight of his brother's name, tears trickled down Harold's cheeks. The staff showed us Dana's draft notice and enlistment card, lists of crew members on the bombing missions he led, a recreation of the officers' barracks. Finally, a volunteer guide took us to the room of sad stories, quote unquote. Displays honored airmen like Lieutenant Joe Kennedy Jr.'s, JFK's brother, killed when his aircraft blew up during a 1944 raid. Turn around, the descent said. The back wall was devoted to Mission 222 and Dana Gary's brave leadership. Photos, diagrams, the story told in detail. Here was the recognition Harold had wanted for his brother. Harold began to weep anew. Chris was crying as well. I had to leave the room, overcome. The next morning, we took the train to Belgium. At customs, I introduced the agent to Harold and told him why we had come. The young man tore the badge from his uniform. Handing it to Harold, "Respect," he exclaimed. "Mad respect." I wasn't sure if Harold understood that mad meant great, but there was no missing the agent's awe. At Aden's American Cemetery, the superintendent from the American Battle Monuments Commission drove us past rows of thousands of white stone crosses. 5,126 veterans were buried there, 65% of them airmen. At last, we came to the row with the cross Harold had waited 78 years to see. Dana E. Gary Captain, quote unquote, was inscribed on it. The superintendent rubbed wet sand from a Normandy beach on the headstone, draped with red, white, and blue flowers I'd ordered in the distance. God Bless America played from the cemetery chapel. There was a chair for Harold in front of the headstone. Stay as long as you want, the superintendent said. The music faded. I read a poem Harold had written. Then Chris and I stepped back. Harold sat before Dan's marker, his head bowed. I let the peace of the moment settle over me and the love of these two brothers. Through the clouds high in the sky, the sun shone down on us like a blessing from above. I knew God was here too. I need you to help me get down on my knees, Harold said. Chris assisted him. Harold touched the ground and said softly, "It won't be long, brother," quote unquote. We returned home changed. Harold no longer speaks about being undeserving of recognition. He spoke at a Memorial Day remembrance service where he received a Gold Star pin for Dan's sacrifice. At a high school Veterans Day program, Harold shared his brother's story and his own. Today, at 103, Harold is an honorary Honor Flight Board member. Before each bus trip, he speaks to the veterans. "Tell your story," he urges. "Talk about your service. It's important that other people know." "I've retired. I have a new purpose that took root long ago, serving those who served, especially my friend Harold Gary. I'm on the board of our local Honor Flight chapter, and I'm helping Harold get his book of Dan's letters republished. I'd signed up for that Honor Flight trip in 2019, looking for a small way to give back. As big as I am on planning, God had a greater plan in mind. He knew Harold and I needed each other to bring our lives full circle." Now, under Generation to Generation, some submittals by readers regarding their relationships with their dads. "The Gift of Time" by Peggy Eastman, Chevy Chase, Maryland. "In his final years, health problems kept my father homebound. I visited often. I brought cornbread, his favorite, but what he really loved was company. We talked about everything, including whether life existed on other planets. Dad was well-read and well-informed. I couldn't fix Dad's health, but I could give him something he prized just as much, my time. It's one of the most valuable gifts you can give someone." And Marilyn Turk of Niceville, Florida, under "Whatever You Set Your Mind To." "My daddy taught my siblings and me to water ski. He took us out on the lake and towed us around until we got it. It was a true gift of love. My daddy never skied. After contracting polio as a child, he had trouble walking, let alone skiing. I never thought of him as disabled. He could swim, side stroke, and he kept himself busy with work and gardening. He was a big fan of Norman Vincent Peale. 'You can do whatever you set your mind to,' quote unquote, my daddy told me. I believe it because I saw him do it." And Gloria Joyce of Willow Grove, Pennsylvania, under "Girl Dad" says, "My dad was a railroad engineer who longed for sons. He got me. Our relationship wasn't easy, but there was one place we bonded, Dad's workbench. He was always building or fixing something. Just because I was a girl didn't mean I couldn't help him. I beamed when he said, 'That girl sure knows her way around a hammer.' I married a man who couldn't hammer a nail to save his life. Dad taught him, then our daughters, Anna and Cassidy. When my girls proudly display their latest home improvement project, I feel Dad's love." And Christy Dewberry from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma writes, "When my father was diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer, everyone in the family was dismayed, except for Dad. 'If I have 6 months to live, I'm going to make them the best months of my life,' he declared. And between treatments, he did. He and Mom went on a cruise. They rode the train from Oklahoma City to Fort Worth. He hosted Oklahoma State football watch parties, took a beach vacation to Florida. Before we knew it, he'd blown past that six-month expiration date. He took daily walks, spent lazy afternoons reading. He loved John Grisham. at his lakeside cabin. His oncologist called him Superman. He inspired other patients. Dad lived 5 fulfilling years after his diagnosis. I was holding his hand when he died. If you feel like God is calling you home, it's okay to go, I said. Dad lived life to the max. I will try to do the same. And now we are going to turn to the Reader's Digest July-August 2024 issue. And the cover article is The Best Drink in Every State. Raise a glass. And it lists each state and which drink is the best. In Alabama, Buffalo Rock Ginger Ale. Born in the basement of Birmingham, Alabama's grocery company in 1901, when grocer Sidney Lee carbonated a pharmacist's extra gingery stomach tonic, the formula, which fans say has a nose-tickling, almost spicy finish, has remained largely unchanged. Alaska, Duck Shot. Arkansas's Grape Pet. This grape soda from Camden first made a big purple splash in the 1940s. California, Wine. Colorado, Hot Cocoa. Connecticut, White Birch Soda. Delaware, Dogfish Head. Florida, Orange Juice. Georgia, Coca-Cola. Hawaii, Pineapple Juice. Idaho, Potato Vodka. Illinois, Old Style. Indiana, Water. Iowa, Nahi Grape. Kansas, Icy. Kentucky, Bourbon. Louisiana, Sazerac. Maine, Moxie. Maryland, Black Eyed Susan. Massachusetts, Cranberry Juice. Michigan, Soda Pop. Minnesota, The Bootleg. Mississippi, Barks Root Beer. Missouri, Fitz's Sodas. Montana, Huckleberry Milkshake. Nebraska, Kool-Aid. Nevada, Pecan Punch or Pecan Punch. New Hampshire, Apple Cider. New Jersey, Green Juice. New Mexico, Agua Fresca. New York, Egg Cream. North Carolina, Cheer Wine. North Dakota, Choke Cherry Wine. Ohio, Tomato Juice. Oklahoma, Cherry Limeade. Oregon, Craft Beer. Pennsylvania, Milk. Rhode Island, Coffee Milk. South Carolina, Sweet Tea. South Dakota, Red Beer. Tennessee, Tennessee Whiskey. Texas, Horchata. Utah, Dirty Soda. Vermont, Maple Lemonade. Virginia, George Washington's Rye Whiskey. Washington, Coffee. West Virginia, Mountain Dew. Wisconsin, Brandy, Old Fashioned. Wyoming, Sloshi. Our next article is under Art of Living, Food, Facts, and Fun. There's more to s'mores. Gather round the fire and we'll tell you. By Emily Tyra. The gooey goodness at the heart of s'mores goes back to the summer of 92. 1892, that is. That year, roasting marshmallows around a campfire became all the rage in seaside towns, according to the reports published in New York World and the Chicago Daily Tribune. Marshmallow roasts are the newest thing, a trend spotter wrote in a dispatch from the New Jersey shore that August. One buys 2 or 3 pounds of marshmallows, invites half a dozen friends to build a small fire in an unfrequented spot on the beach, away from crowds unfamiliar with so refined a species of entertainment. The writer noted the fad was an excellent medium for flirtation, appropriately exhibited by nibbling the marshmallows of each other's sticks. Graham crackers and chocolate bars soon followed. The Graham crackers inventor, Presbyterian minister Sylvester Graham, died in 1851, so he never saw his namesake snack become a commercial success. By the turn of the century, bakers were selling their own sweeter versions, and in 1900, Hershey's released its famed milk chocolate bars, becoming a household name. Who was the first to combine all three components? The Girl Scouts, experts in both campfires and cookies. Their 1927 tome, Tramping and Trailing with the Girl Scouts, features sing-alongs and survival skills, including an all-important lesson on how to toast two marshmallows over the coals to a crisp, gooey state, and then place them inside a graham cracker and chocolate bar sandwich. The author's quip, though it tastes like some more, one is really enough, even gave the treat its name. But in truth, one some more will never be enough, especially if its ongoing popularity is any indication. An oven-baked riff on the s'mores developed by food writer Nia Artizan and viewed 8 million times on TikTok starts with the requisite recipe, but adds a scoop of chocolate chip cookie dough mounded and baked on top, transforming it into a cookie marvel. Meanwhile, Pinterest contains a smorgasbord of s'mores boards with pretty rows of graham crackers, marshmallows, and exotic flavors of chocolate bars, plus peanut butter cups, cookies, berries, peanut butter, jam, and hazelnut spread. Chefs and culinary entrepreneurs are making s'mores statements too. Manhattan pastry chef Daniel Alvarez created a stunning s'mores pavlova with toasted marshmallow ganache, speculoos ice cream made with crumbled Biscoff cookies, and molten chocolate cake batter. Artisan S'mores Company, S'morology, launched in West Covina, California, ships gourmet kits all over the country. And in Indianapolis, a startup called S'mores Circles makes small batches of frozen s'mores on sticks and delivers them via a teal tricycle they call the s'more cycle. As variations on the toasted trifecta make their rounds this summer, you may get the feeling, that warm, toasty feeling, that if you're willing to snag the supplies and stoke a fire, you can always count on a classic. Under the healthy, wellness from thehealthy.com. Who's getting colon cancer? With rates rising among younger people, testing should start sooner. By Charlotte Hilton Anderson. Jana Boyer was 54 in June 2021 when she and her husband traveled to Mexico to renew their wedding vows. As they were getting ready to fly home, she started experiencing stomach problems. She called her doctor, who recommended she get checked out by a gastroenterologist to see if she picked up a parasite from contaminated food or water. My sister-in-law is a retired colorectal nurse, and she's been bugging me to get a colonoscopy since I turned 50. Boyer says, I kept putting it off, but I figure I might as well kill two birds with one stone. That colonoscopy probably saved her life. The procedure detected a mass measuring 3 centimeters in her large intestine. Further tests determined that the mass was malignant, and she immediately had surgery, followed by 6 months of chemotherapy. Until her trip to Mexico, Boyer hadn't experienced any symptoms that might have been signs of colon cancer. Most colorectal cancers cause no symptoms in the early stage when they are most treatable, explains Felicide May, a gastroenterologist and an associate professor of medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. This is why we're starting at age 45. Everyone needs to get screened for colorectal cancer, regardless of whether you have symptoms or not. Those symptoms, when they do occur, include rectal bleeding, blood in the stool, constipation, and other sudden bowel changes. Before 2021, the recommendation for people at average risk of colon cancer to begin screening at age 50. But because of a rising rate of the disease among younger people, the recommended age to begin now is 45. People at higher risk, those with a family history of colorectal cancer, for example, should start screening even earlier. Last year, the American Cancer Society reported that 20% of colorectal cancer cases in 2019 were in patients under the age 55, about double the rate from 25 years earlier. Yet, in spite of these troubling statistics, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reports that fewer than 60% of adults age 45 to 75 have been screened for this disease. Colonoscopy versus home tests. The colonoscopy is considered the gold standard for colorectal cancer screening. It is a procedure in which a small tube with a light and a lens is passed through the rectum and intestines, allowing doctors to see any growths or irregularities. If the doctor discovers polyps, small growths, quote unquote, in the intestines, they can be removed through the tube. Most of these polyps are benign, but there is a risk that over time they could turn cancerous. While many people feel squeamish about the test, most who have had one admit it's really not so bad. The day before the test, people drink a lot of liquids, some of which include a laxative to induce diarrhea and clean out the bowel, which will enable doctors to see the intestine walls clearly. While that may sound unpleasant, it is mainly just inconvenient, requiring that you stay close to a bathroom until the prep is finished. Patients are sedated for the colonoscopy procedure, which is usually painless. Still squeamish? Some people may be able to do a home test instead. The home tests aren't recommended for anyone with a personal or family history of polyps or colon cancer, but they're considered a good alternative for people who have no underlying risk factors and who are unable or unwilling to have a colonoscopy. Unfortunately, the home test is not without its ick factor either. Several tests have been approved by the FDA, Cologuard, which requires a prescription, is one of the most well-known. All require that you collect a stool sample, then mail it to a laboratory to be tested for microscopic or invisible blood, and sometimes DNA that may indicate the presence of cancer. And if the test result is positive, then you'll have to have a colonoscopy anyway. Researchers are still trying to develop even easier and less icky ways to detect colon cancer while it's still early. While there is a blood test available to test for colon cancer, it is not as accurate as a test described above. But recently, researchers announced that a new blood test still under development can detect genetic material that tumors shed into the bloodstream. In a trial of almost 8,000 people, the new test accurately detected early colon cancer almost 90% of the time. Jana Boyer's cancer is in remission now, but she'll continue to be carefully monitored. She said she is grateful for many things these days, including the opportunity to share her story with others and spread the message about the importance of colon cancer screening. After you read this, she says, reach out to your doctor to see whether you should be screened. Water flosser. I've had more cavities than I'd like to admit. Plus, a couple of crowns, and my dental hygienist warned me recently that my sensitive gums were receding and at risk for periodontal disease. I remember my dad having extensive and expensive periodontal work done, and I'd like to avoid that for myself. So at my dentist's recommendation, I started using a water flosser. I chose a handheld rechargeable one. Water flossing can be messy if you're not careful, which is why my hygienist says she uses hers in the shower. And when I'm extra tired at bedtime, I'm tempted to skip it. But my dentist says it's helping. And a 2023 review in the journal Curious found that the water flossers are better than dental floss for removing food, plaque, and bacteria. Yes, I use regular floss, and I brush with an electric toothbrush as instructed by my dentist, and my gums are holding steady, so I plan to keep it up no matter how tired I am. That was Lynn Smith. News from the World of Medicine by Beth Winehouse. The brainy benefits of daily multivitamin. Wouldn't it be nice if there were a simple, safe pill you could take to ward off dementia? According to new research from Brigham and Women's Hospital, part of Harvard Medical School, and the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, that magic pill might be a daily multivitamin. In the final of three studies looking at multivitamins' benefits for heart disease, cancer, and other health issues, researchers found that a daily multivitamin improved memory and slowed cognitive aging, says Joanne Manson, MD, a leader of the study and chief of the Division of Preventative Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. The investigators estimated that taking the daily multivitamin over the 3 years of study slowed cognitive aging by approximately 60%, which is the equivalent of almost 2 years of life. Your partner, your blood pressure. If your partner has high blood pressure, you might be on your way to having high blood pressure too. That's the finding of a large multinational study that set out to investigate if many married couples, also who often share the same interests, living environment, lifestyle habits, and health outcomes, might also share high blood pressure, says Jeanette Sam Varghese, a faculty member at the Emory Global Diabetes Research Center in Atlanta. Varghese and the other scientists looked at thousands of couples across United States, England, China, and India, finding a clear link where blood pressure was concerned. Based on the results, which were published in the Journal of the American Heart Association, improving blood pressure, too, can be a family affair. Can't stop stress eating? If you've ever suspected that stress might be the reason for your weight gain, science has just found an explanation. According to a new study published in the Journal of Physiology and Behavior, stress can actually make food taste worse, reducing the reward people get from eating. This may cause them to eat more to feel satisfied. In the study, 76 people were evaluated and placed in either a high-stress or low-stress group. Then they were given large amounts of two soups, one sweet and one savory, and told to eat as much as they wanted. People who were highly stressed didn't enjoy the taste of either soup as much as the people with low stress levels did. While there wasn't a lot of difference in the amount eaten, the researchers say that in real life, not enjoying certain foods as much as expected could lead people to seek satisfaction by eating and overeating other foods. Colon cancer risks. A survey of 1,000 adults done at Ohio State University found that many didn't know about the lifestyle factors that can increase colon cancer risk. Contributing factors to watch include obesity, drinking alcohol, lack of physical activity, and a diet high in fat and processed foods. And, of course, everyone should start having regular colonoscopies at age 45 or earlier if you have any known risk factors or if your doctor advises. A nutty way to better health. One in three Americans has at least three risk factors for cardiovascular disease, such as high blood sugar, high cholesterol, high triglycerides, and excess fat around the middle, a condition called metabolic syndrome. All these things increase a person's risk for heart attack, stroke, other cardiovascular events, and diabetes. But it looks as if people who regularly eat walnuts have some protection. Iranian researchers writing in the Journal of Food Science and Nutrition looked at multiple studies and found that people who regularly eat walnuts tended to have better markers of metabolic health. Walnuts also seem to combat some complications of diabetes. One study even found that walnut eaters had a 68% lower risk of having diabetes compared to the non-walnut eaters. So go ahead and sprinkle some walnuts on your morning yogurt. But don't go overboard. Walnuts are high in fat, and even though it's healthy fat, they are still relatively high in calories. And under your true stories, these are contributed by Reader Digest readers. Won't you be our neighbor? These folks do Mr. Rogers proud. Cold treats, warm hearts. I wondered who our neighbors would be when we bought land for our new house. I didn't have to wonder long. On a hot day, a beautiful and pregnant woman walked across the field with popsicles for us. Rochelle and I were both expecting our fourth daughters, and all our girls lined up within a year of one another. Our family spent the next 22 years making memories between our homes. They had to move out for a year about a decade ago while their house was rebuilt after a fire. They moved back in on Christmas Eve. but the kitchen wasn't done, so I suggested they come over on Christmas for a big breakfast in our pajamas. Now every year we go back and forth. We knew a few popsicles. Who knew a few popsicles would have such an impact? By Conda Corey of Wausau, Indiana. Forgive thy neighbor. Our Sunday afternoons, my neighbor Dick and I often mowed our lawns. Most people wouldn't give it a second thought, but we were both pastors who encouraged our parishioners to make Sunday a day of rest. On such occasions, we'd meet at the fence, confess our sin, assure each other of divine forgiveness, and then finish the job. Paul Bailey of Fayetteville, New York. Keeping it in the family. My sister Lynn and I were close growing up, but our lives took different directions after high school. Decades later, she was divorcing and needed a place to live. I'd been thinking of buying the home across the street as an investment, and the owner agreed to sell it to me at a discounted neighbor rate. My sister moved in the day I closed, happy to be in town with her grandkids. Now she and I are closer than ever, exactly 100 feet toward a door. That was Christine Cohen of Charlotte, North Carolina. A good place to plant roots. When I moved into my new house, I noticed a woman next door working long hours in her garden. A few weeks later, Claudia knocked on my door, reluctantly informing me that our puppy had crawled through the fence and dug up every vegetable she planted 4 times. I apologized profusely and built a better fence. I also helped replant every vegetable right alongside her and helped with weeding all summer. Not only did Claudia teach me about gardening and share the harvest, we also bonded during those sessions and have been inseparable since. She taught me to knit so I could make ski sweaters for my kids, and we organized my parents' 40th anniversary party together. I even wiggled through her doggy door when she locked herself out. I can't imagine a better friend or neighbor. That was Lisa Lambert of Denver, Colorado. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you for listening.